Thanks. Let me begin by going over the main point of the lecture last time. There's a big theoretical issue that we were concerned with there. This is this issue of the role of structure versus agency in international politics. How much does the system count for? The system of great power politics count for, as opposed to statecraft, the choices that are made at the national level versus the whole international environment, and especially the distribution of power in the system. And the normal way of approaching that issue, before you've had any exposure to international relations theory, is that you want to understand the causes of war. It's simple. You look at policy. You look at the choices that different countries make, especially in the case of aggressive countries like Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, Fascist Italy in the 1930s. Very simple understanding the origins of the Second World War. It has to do with the particular policies that those countries pursued, above all Nazi Germany. All right? That's the natural view. People look at the Cold War. How's the Cold War understood? It's understood in terms of the aggressive Soviet Union versus the peace-loving democracies that were pursuing a purely defensive policy. Over and over again, when you look at the literature on the causes of war, or especially the popular literature, it focuses on statecraft. It plays down the role of structure. It plays down the role of, you know, amoral power considerations in shaping behavior. Okay? So it's against that backdrop that you could appreciate the contribution of international relations theory. You know, how many of you have heard of Kenneth Waltz? Less than half the class. Kenneth Waltz is the probably the premier international relations theorist in the United States today. And Waltz owes his eminence to the argument that structure is of absolutely fundamental importance in determining what happens in the international sphere. Not that it counts for everything, but that it's a lot more important than people think. You know, it's a structural interpretation. Waltz's theory, often called neorealism, it also goes by the name of structural realism because it emphasizes the importance of structure. You don't need to have aggressors to have wars. You know, these problems are built into the very structure of the system. Right? Well, that view is powerful because it's counterintuitive. But how accurate is it? How do you get at that question of how to assess how much power, how much validity a particular theoretical approach has? How do you get at that issue? You get at that issue by looking at the historical record and trying to understand how important structure is as opposed to statecraft. How much the system counts for as opposed to the particular policy choices that are made at the national level. How locked in are people by the environment in which they find themselves? To what extent are their choices constrained by the nature of the world in which they find themselves? Right? That's a very important issue, and the only way of getting a handle on that is by looking at the past through that lens, right? Trying to get a feel for how to strike the balance. Because obviously, when you think about it, both kinds of things have to enter into the equation, right? Obviously, statecraft counts for something. It's more than zero. And obviously, it doesn't count for everything. The environment obviously has to be taken into account. But can you get a feel for how to strike the balance? That's the basic problem that we're confronted with. So how do you get a handle on that problem? By looking at the great events of the past and trying to understand the degree to which they're to be understood in structural terms as opposed to in terms of human agency. And so that was the point of the lecture last time, right? People think that you want to understand the Second World War. Very simple. Look in the 1930s. Look at Hitler. You don't even have to concern yourself with the 1920s. You know, very sharp dividing line between the 20s and the 30s. The 20s is the era of hope. The 30s is when the shadows start to really darken. The 20s is late 20s especially, is a period of prosperity. The 1930s is a period of depression. 1920s, you had Germany being run by good Europeans, like this is the view, like Gustav Stresemann. 1930s, there are these evil, demonic figures like Hitler. Yeah, very sharp distinction. Germany's a democracy in the 1920s. Germany is a Nazi dictatorship in the 1930s. Very sharp dividing line between the 20s and 30s. So the view that you want to understand war, you focus on policy. You focus on the aggressive policies of like dictator states, right? That's associated with a certain interpretation of the interwar period. It's associated with a certain interpretation of the 1920s, an interpretation in particular of German policy in the 1920s. Whereas the other view, the view that emphasizes structure, in effect, is associated with a very different view of the history of that period. This is the idea that since power realities don't change dramatically from year to year, the distribution of power is very much a function of the distribution of economic resources, which is more or less consistent from year to year. You don't really expect such dramatic changes. You expect much more of continuity. You don't expect a sharp dividing line between the 20s and the 30s. It's much more to be understood in terms of shades of gray, right? So these different theoretical approaches are associated with different historical interpretations. There are affinities between these things, right? So by studying the history, you can get some insight into the theoretical issue. That was the point last time. You look at the 1920s, these historical interpretations of the 1920s, about Stresemann as the good European, Stresemann as man of peace, the problem basically, problems that lay at the heart of the system having been resolved, and you've left the turmoil of the immediate post-war period behind, and now the West European countries, Germany, Britain, France, have managed to find something of a modus vivendi with each other, with the implication that if it hadn't been for the Great Depression, and it hadn't been for Hitler coming to power, everything would have been nice and sweet. Right? So we examined that in light of the evidence. And it turns out, no, it's not really true. There were basic structural problems that had not been resolved even at the end of the 1920s. We saw this when we focused on Stresemann's aims. He's not reconciled to the maintenance of the status quo. He wants Germany to annex Austria. He wants Germany to get back the territories lost to Poland after the war. He even wants ultimately to get Alsace Lorraine back in terms of ultimate goals, and also in terms of method. The use of force is not ruled out. The key thing is to build up Germany's power. That means German rearmament. That means resisting the Versailles system to the extent possible. Not headlong rebellion against it, but using these methods of finessing the situation, telling the Allies what you know they want to hear so they'll let you get away with things. playing the Soviet card, threatening to align themselves more with the Soviet Union if the Allies don't give them what they want. I remember my very first paper in graduate school in 1966. There was a volume of German diplomatic documents from 1926 that had just been published, and my job was to go through those documents and see what they told us about the story. And it was just amazing. There was a very conscious, explicit debate within the German Foreign Office in 1926 about which way to go. And there were basically three strategies. There were the Westerners who said, in effect, we must not reject the outstretched hand. The Westerners said, Britain and France want to reach an accommodation with us. It's to our interest to bury the hatchet with these people. These are the good Europeans. These are the people who foreshadowed West German policy after World War II. In fact, Konrad Adenauer, the great maker of German policy in the post-World War II period, was one of these people in the 1920s, who was active in German political life in the 1920s. The Westerners, right? You don't want a war or even bad relations with Britain and France. You want to kind of construct a West European community that can stand on its own, especially against the communist threat from the East, but to a certain extent also against America, which these kind of more conservative West Europeans had considerable distaste then, as in fact they still do. Then there were the Easterners. These are the people who preached revolt against Versailles by aligning Germany with Soviet Russia. Right? These were the two countries that had been excluded from the Versailles settlement, that had an interest in changing it. Together they could rise up against it. And they were important people, including the German ambassador to the Soviet Union, the Count Ulrich von Brockdorff-Rantzau, who was a big proponent of that approach. But the dominant people, Stresemann and the state secretary in the German Foreign Office, this guy named Karl von Schubelt, they took a middle line. Their whole idea is, we don't want to side with either the East or with the West. We want to play these two sides against each other. We want to threaten the West that if they don't give us what we want, we'll go and align ourselves more with the East, and we'll threaten the communists in Russia that if they don't accommodate us, we'll side with the West. And by balancing between East and West in that way, playing the East versus the West off against each other in that way. German term for this is Schaukelpolitik. You know, the policy of balancing, of playing off. You know, that's the way Germany could recover her power. Throw off the shackles of Versailles, build up Germany's armed forces, and once Germany develops her armed forces up to the point where she's really capable of defending herself, there's nothing to stop Germany from building them up to the level where Germany would once again dominate Europe, more so than in 1914, for the reasons that I discussed in previous lectures. I'm sorry, did you have a question? Oh, you don't have to know these names. Probably the leading figure was the ambassador in London, whose name is von Hirsch. But you don't have to know this stuff. It's like, basically, there's this debate. There are these three factions. The central faction, the idea of, you know, playing the game of power politics, you know, playing your adversaries off against each other. Very much like the United States was supposed to have done during the 1970s, playing off Russia against China. You know, these people said, this is the way to go. Power politics is the way to go. And, of course, the West, Britain and France, they were terribly disappointed because they thought that the whole idea of the Locarno policy is that the Germans would not play that game, would not resort to the politics of pressure, the politics of force, you know, to power politics. That instead the Germans would become good Europeans, right? But the Germans continue to resist in all these different areas. And Stresemann was very much in favor of continuing that policy of resistance because the goal was to build up German power. And you couldn't do it overnight. It was step by step. You had to take advantage of the fact that the Allies wanted to kind of create this new world, this new, much more peaceful world. So you tell them what you know they want to hear. The German term for this is finanzieren, to finesse the whole problem, so that Germany could make its way through the danger zone to the point where force could not be used against them. And once they made their way through the danger zone, then they could do all these things, remilitarize the Rhineland, fortify their borders, build up their armed forces, and when their armed forces were built up to the level they were physically capable of, then they could talk in a much tougher tone with regard to the change in the territorial status quo in the East. Right? All this is quite important, because it meant that there was a continuing structural problem. Whose power is going to dominate Europe? Doesn't matter if Germany's a democracy or not. You're going to have these problems having to do with the question of power. Are the French going to simply sit on their hands while Germany builds up their power and allow Germany to totally overshadow them? If that's the case, what was the point of fighting the war? So the French have a kind of incentive not to go along with this, but on the other hand, in the long run, aren't the French dependent on Britain and America, and Britain and America don't like the idea of using force against Germany? What about the British? They see all this stuff going on. The Germans are not playing the game, as the British said at that time. The Germans were continuing to resist, continuing to use the methods of power politics. But what are they going to do? The great British diplomatist of the late 19th century, Lord Salisbury, once said that the commonest error in politics is sticking to the carcasses of dead policies. I love that quotation. That's one of these kind of one-size-fits-all quotations. You know, it's like, you're looking at the Obama policy. The communist era in politics is sticking to the carcasses of dead policy. I mean, the George W. Bush, you know, and so on. It's a one-size-fits-all quotation, but it applies with particular force to the late 1920s. What are they going to do? Say, to tell their own people, sorry, the whole policy we pursued at Locarno and all this stuff we've been telling you about how we've entered into this wonderful new world of peace, you can't take that seriously anymore. We're giving our Nobel Peace Prizes back, et cetera, et cetera. They can't go that route. They can't admit the bankruptcy of their own policy, but their heart isn't in it. It's like, you know, the Duracell bunny. They just keep going along with the same old policy, even though they kind of in their hearts know there isn't much of a chance that it could succeed. So they do make all of these concessions, hoping against hope that Germany is going to be reconciled and Germany will basically bury the hatchet. But the concessions don't do the trick. And what are those concessions? I rattled them off at the end of the lecture last time. Right? The removal of military control from Germany in 1927. The commissions that were to oversee the disarmament of Germany were pulled out, making it much easier for the Germans to rearm illegally. Right? 1930, the last Allied troops are pulled out of the Rhineland, meaning the Allies have much less in the way of pressure. What can they threaten the Germans with if they're not in the Rhineland anymore? If they use military force against Germany, wouldn't they be in violation of the Treaty of Versailles? Of the Treaty of Locarno, even, which said that they shouldn't use force against Germany, except after getting the approval of the League, which is this big cumbersome process. No one takes that too seriously. And then finally, December 1932, 1 month before Hitler comes to power in Germany, you have the Germans being granted their central demand. This is, and I had that German term in the outline last time, Gleichberechtigung, equality of rights in matters of armament. Right? The Germans are given the same right to arm that the Allies have. Right? This is the end of Versailles, effectively, before Hitler comes to power, you understand. Germany is now more or less free to rearm. And the argument was, we have to give this to the Germans, because if we don't give it to them, they'll just take it anyway, and then what will we do? We can't use force against them for a variety of reasons that I'll discuss. Okay? Versailles is dead before Hitler comes to power. the problems are not resolved. The problems of whose power will dominate Europe are not resolved. Problems having to do with Germany being inherently such a strong country, not resolved. What's the proof that they're not resolved? What's the proof that these problems are remain salient even in the 1920s, before the Depression hits? It's the chronology. The decision on the part of the French to build the Maginot Line was made in 1929. What's the Maginot Line? The Maginot Line is a line of fortifications going across the Franco-German border. Providing France with security against the German attack. It's important for all kinds of reasons. Spending a lot of money on these fortifications. This is evidence of their anxiety about what's going to happen in the future when Germany becomes strong and France is going to be vulnerable to German attack. Well, this at least will allow the French to defend themselves. That was a lesson of World War I, that you can't really break through a highly fortified border like that. Okay, underground bunkers, with all these kind of reinforced concrete fortifications, all these guns, protecting France against German attack. 1929, they go this route. Okay? It's also important in another way. Every country only has a finite amount of money they could spend for military purposes. The more you spend on defensive forces, like the Maginot Line, the less is going to be available for offensive military capability. You opt for a defensive strategy, you're depriving yourself of the ability to launch offensive military operations into Germany. But if you can't threaten Germany with attack, what leverage do you have against Germany in the event the Germans do something you don't like remilitarize the Rhineland, rearm at a very quick pace, begin to threaten their eastern neighbors, move to annex Austria and so on? You have no leverage whatsoever. Yeah? You'd think, but the idea is if you block off the Franco-German border, then you could concentrate your regular forces there. And then there's the other problem of if you build it through Belgium, then you're kind of dependent on the Belgians to kind of go along with this. Belgium is in a difficult position vis-a-vis Germany. Belgium is an ally of France after World War I. But Belgium reverts to neutrality as German power increases in 1936. If they had built the Maginot Line through Belgium, all those fortifications basically would have been wasted. If they had simply built the Maginot Line south of Belgium on French territory, then in effect they would be writing off Belgium. And plus, to cover that whole area from the Swiss border to the sea, rather than just along the Franco-German border where there are mountains, the Vosges Mountains, to build it straight through the sea along the North European plain is much, much more expensive than just building the Maginot Line that they had. So there are a variety of reasons that they didn't do that. Okay, all these things suggest that there's much greater continuity between the 20s and 30s than you would think. That structure counts for a lot more than you would think. But you'd never want to take that sort of argument too far. Always it's a question of balance. You never want to say, so therefore structure is the only thing that matters. Changes in the political leadership, changes in the sorts of policy choices that are made, that doesn't count for anything. Because it is quite clear that the coming to power of Adolf Hitler in Germany in January of 1933 makes an enormous difference, both in terms of the ultimate goals that Germany is aiming at and also the methods that Germany is going to pursue in order to reach those goals. Much more of a forward policy, much more ambitious than anything that was contemplated under Weimar. Okay? Nazi foreign policy. What's it directed at ultimately? At transforming Germany's position in the world, at carving a great German-dominated and ultimately German-populated empire in the East, above all in the Ukraine. This important grain-producing area here, this whole area is going to become a huge German empire. Its existing inhabitants, enslaved, ultimately wiped out, populated by German settlers, German farmers. That's the essence of the Nazi policy. Why do they want something like that? Because ultimately that's the only way that Germany could survive in the world, the notion is. And a world of these super empires, these extremely large great powers like the Soviet Union, the United States, even the British Empire. The only way a country is not going to be totally eclipsed in the long run is by acquiring an adequate territorial base under its own political control, enabling it to sustain itself, to defend itself in that new world. The idea is, well, yes, for the time being, you don't have to worry about having territory, because you could always engage in international trade. You can produce finished goods, and you could import the food that you need. But this is not going to last forever. They're just convinced of this. It's not going to last forever, because sooner or later, populations are going to grow to the point where the question of how they're going to be fed becomes salient. And countries are always going to look after their own people first. And when that happens, you're not going to be able to import the food you need, and your own nation is going to be utterly at the mercy of the food-producing countries in the world. So these questions, you know, how many mouths to feed, you know, how much food, you know, how much land to produce it, necessarily in the long run lie at the heart of international politics. Now, that's Nazi philosophy. That's why they feel they need to create this, you know, this German empire to acquire all this land in the East. Is this something that's unique to the Nazis, or did it have much deeper roots? Answer, the latter. This is not unique to them. This is a philosophy that was rooted in the social Darwinism of the late 19th century. Social Darwinism, the application of Darwin's thinking to human relations is a very, very important element of the story of great power politics before the First World War. The Darwin philosophy, survival of the fittest through natural selection. It's a materialist, amoral philosophy. The only thing that matters in determining what happens is what aids, you know, a given species to survive. Right? Survival is the only thing that counts. No, you know, and in the natural world, animals will do whatever they have to do to maximize their chances of survival. You know, this is a view, an amoral view of nature. You know, nature red in tooth and claw. And it has implications about human affairs, because human beings are also a biological species. Right? It's materialist. It rejects the old notions of natural law associated with an age that was, that took religion seriously. Now, the important thing to note about social Darwinism is that the Darwinist philosophy wasn't really bought by British society or French society in the late 19th century. It had limitations. As a matter of fact, one scholar who's studied these things has actually referred to the Darwinist non-revolution, because these Darwinist conceptions were only to a limited extent translated into thinking about you know, how international politics works. Britain, United States, France, but in Germany they were taken much more seriously. This is 19th century. I should just say that there's an important point to be made about this type of thinking, because this was taken up by the Nazis after the war and was made a centerpiece of their thinking about international politics. A lot of people say, well, it's because of the war. The war was so awful that it transformed the way people in Britain and France thought about these things. This whole, you know, very raw view of international politics was replaced by this notion that there has to be limits. We have to think in terms of moral principles and so on. Because war itself is so awful. Having won the war, they viewed the problem as the war itself. Germany, having lost the war, they viewed the problem as the fact that Germany had lost, Germany's defeat. So they viewed things somewhat differently, and they looked at these huge, you know, empires. Like I say, British Empire, French Empire, United States had expanded across this entire continent, exterminating the original inhabitants of that continent. Now that they had acquired everything they wanted, they turned around and said, oh, no, we have to look at things very differently now. Everything now has to be based on the rule of law. And the German attitude was, this is just pure cant. So this was the view that the Germans bought into, but as I said, there's something very odd about it. Because if you look at the population tables for the 20th century, and you find that decade after decade, in time of peace, in time of war, in time of prosperity, in time of depression, it doesn't matter. You find the same underlying trend. You find birth rates declining and death rates also declining. But the birth rates decline more rapidly than the death rates, which means that the rate of population increase levels off. The whole fear of how are we going to feed all these babies being born was based on the notion that populations are going to continue increasing by leaps and bounds, to the point where, if you kind of exclude immigration, the populations of Europe today are pretty much stable, if not declining slightly. Okay. Whereas food production, the changes are absolutely dramatic in the course of the 20th century. The productivity of agriculture just grows by leaps and bounds. And, you know, we talk about the Green Revolution and new seeds and so on. A lot of it has to do with the production of fertilizers, nitrogen-based fertilizers. You all know that the air is 80% nitrogen. You can just take the nitrogen from the air and produce fertilizers, plow those fertilizers into the soil. It is just amazing how agricultural production has increased. So the great fear of the late 19th century, where are we going to feed all these people, is replaced in our own day with this problem of agricultural surpluses in both the United States and Western Europe. If someone had predicted this in the late 19th century, people would have said, this couldn't be. This is kind of crazy. The social Darwinist philosophy ignored both of those fundamental long-term trends. So the problem was not nearly as acute as people thought. Certainly than the Nazis thought. And this is the basis of Nazi thinking. Okay. How do they go about trying? And it's laid out by Hitler in his book Mein Kampf, which he wrote when he was imprisoned after the failed Nazi putsch in Munich in 1923. And the book was published in, 1925-26, in two volumes. Okay. So Hitler comes to power. He has this dream, these long-term goals. Not quite a program for achieving them. But he does have certain instincts about how policy should be conducted. The key thing is Germany is going to have to pass through a danger zone. There's a risk that the other pals will see what Germany is up to and intervene against Germany before it's too late. It's like Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda chief, he says in 1933 that there's a real danger of preventive war against Germany because, you know, after all, can't they just read what Hitler wrote? You know, and how could you allow someone who said these kinds of things to just stay in power when you have the physical ability of intervening against Germany? Because Germany's still weak in the beginning. So Hitler has the goal of steering Germany through the danger zone. And how does he do it? You keep the intact a lot of the structures that had come into being in earlier periods. Your foreign minister is a traditional diplomat. His name is Neurath. A lot of the people like who are in charge of German policy during the early Nazi period, like the economic czar, his name is Hjalmar Schacht, were veterans of German policy from the 1920s. They were very well known to people in the West and so on. A lot of people said, well, they talk wild, but when they come to power, the realities of power will sober them. Right? And you wanted to kind of feed into that. And then Hitler gave these speeches, these with the kind of pacifist overtones. He was a veteran of the First World War. He knew what war was like. He was intent on doing everything that had to be done, consistent with German dignity and avoiding a new war. And, you know, you had a lot of that stuff. On the diplomatic front, he did what he had to do to reduce the threat by trying to make Germany as respectable as possible. The Nazi government made a concordat with the Vatican, for example. The Germans tried to make bilateral pacts with their neighbors, including Poland, the non-aggression pact with Poland in 1934. Nazi anti-Semitism was not a problem for the Poles. The Poles told the Germans that if Hitler succeeded in solving the Jewish problem, they would erect a statue to him in Warsaw. But the fear on the part of Germany was that Germany might have to face a two-front war, a fight against both Poland and France. And so making a bilateral agreement with Poland tended to reduce that danger. So you have caution as being the keynote of German foreign policy, 33, 34, even into 35. 1935, the Germans make an important agreement with the British, the Anglo-German naval agreement in 1935, in which the Germans accepted to have permanent naval inferiority vis-a-vis the British. The German fleet would only be 35% as large as the British fleet. And this is rooted in, again, an astute calculation on the part of Hitler. He looked back at German policy before World War I, and in some regards, he sympathized with the imperial aspirations of the German government at that time. His problem was the way they tried to achieve their goals. You know, it's like, it was crazy from Hitler's standpoint that the government of William II had quarrels with the three next most important powers in Europe all at the same time. You know, there's quarrel with France over Alsace-Lorraine, the quarrel with Russia over all these Balkan issues because Austria was Germany's ally. And then, as though that were not enough, they picked this quarrel with the British, you know, focusing on these imperial, naval, and colonial issues, the naval arms race that they conducted against Britain before World War I. This is crazy. If the Germans make it clear to the British that they will, you know, have no desire to destroy the British Empire, that they accept British naval supremacy and so on, then the British will reciprocate by allowing Germany free hand in Europe. So that's Hitler's hope. It's not an absurd hope. And to do that, they make this agreement accepting naval inferiority. Okay? So you have this keynote of caution in German policy before in the early Nazi period. Okay? How does the West react? The Germans are doing everything they can to assuage any concern that the West feels, but they can't ignore what's going on in Germany. You know, Germany is not a closed country the way Soviet Russia was. You know, you could foreigners could visit Germany without any problem. And it was very clear what was going on in Germany, the militarization of the whole society from the, you know, children on up, the Hitler Youth and, you know, stormtroopers and, you know, all these parades with, you know, everyone dressed up in military uniforms, paramilitary uniforms and so on. The kind of rhetoric, warlike rhetoric and so on that was being used internally in Germany to kind of mobilize and make the people, you know, prepare for war, prepare for armed struggle. Plus the anti-Semitism also. These were certainly sources of concern outside of Germany, in Britain and France, no matter what the Germans were doing. How can you deal with it? Right? Direct use of force, you know, the sort of thing that Goebbels was afraid of, out of the question. Preventive war, you know, out of your mind? We can't use force. Force is not legitimate in international politics for purposes other than self-defense. You can't intervene. It doesn't matter the Germans are violating the treaty. If the use of force is considered illegitimate, then you just have to accept it. Accept that Germany is pursuing that course of action. I should say, you know, think about the parallel, you know, a decade ago in the run-up to the war with Iraq. Doesn't matter, a lot of people said that Iraq is not keeping her promises, violating her commitments. You shouldn't use force against Iraq. The use of force, preemptive war, preventive war, all this is very bad. Well, those notions that we saw in our own country, they're very common in the liberal political culture. And meant that, no, we don't like it, but we have to remember that we're in large part responsible because we imposed this awful Versailles peace and this enraged the Germans, and so their attitude is understandable and we're just going to have to kind of ride it out. Very common attitudes in Britain and France during that period. The French, they, however, think that you can't just turn a blind eye to what's going on in Germany, but you could react to it in traditional ways. Arms and alliances, basically alliances. Constructing a grand coalition, ignoring ideology, and putting together a coalition of all the states that feel threatened by Germany. All the major powers outside of Germany. France and Britain most notably, because even the British have to be concerned about the emergence of this German superpower. If Germany conquers all this land in the east, then Germany is going to totally outshadow her West European neighbors, and their security is going to be imperiled. So the British have to be concerned. Fascist Italy, they have to be concerned because the last thing they want is to have a powerful Germany on their borders by Germany annexing Austria. Who knows? The Italians had gained territory, including territory inhabited by German-speaking people, after World War I, when the Upper Tyrol, what the Italians call the Alto Adige. Maybe the Germans, once they become stronger, are going to demand that back. In any case, the prospect of a German-dominated Europe is not particularly pleasant to Mussolini. He would have to become a satellite of Germany. Soviet Union, obviously, this country should be alarmed by the rise of German power because they're the main target. So you could put together a coalition of those four great powers. That should be enough to keep Germany checked. This is the policy that's pursued by the French government, headed by, it's a Dumas government, but the foreign minister is named Louis Barthou. 1934, we will provide for security by our own means. Proceeds to move ahead. the actual implementation of this policy was a different matter, especially since Barthou was assassinated and replaced by Pierre Laval. But Laval continued and negotiated the Franco-Soviet Pact in 1935. Laval was very interested in cultivating good relations also with Mussolini's Italy. Could this have worked? Well, it was one thing to restrain Germany when she was weak. But once Germany had really built up her power, fully rearmed up to the level that she was capable of, remilitarized the Rhineland, because who was going to stop Germany from doing that once Germany was really strong? France couldn't threaten Germany with attack. France didn't have the forces to do so. You know, France didn't have these offensive forces because she had been put basically all her ships in defense, in the Maginot Line, the reasons that I noted before. It's a line of fortifications along the Franco-German border. Okay? So once Germany is strong, she doesn't have to worry about defending her western border. What's going to prevent her from moving east? France can't move against her. Right? What's going to happen if Germany takes over Austria or demands territorial concessions from Poland? Say, in the case of the Poles, what are the Poles going to do? Invite the Soviets to come in and help them? Soviets, from their point of view, are even worse than the Germans. You know, this structure, this grand alliance structure that Barthou would hope to create in such an event would become a house of cards. And, of course, the Germans see all this. They understand it all. You know, none of these things are secret. The next step comes in 1936, March of 1936. Germans had tested the waters. They had done all these things the previous year, 1935. Reintroduced conscription, right, in 1935. Announced that they had constructed an air force, illegal under the Treaty of Versailles. No one does anything. March of 1936, they make the key step. This is the remilitarization of the Rhineland. How the French react? You know, this is a violation not just of Versailles, but of Locarno. The Germans had accepted the demilitarized status of the Rhineland. The strategic implications of this are far-reaching. It means that Germany is free to move toward the east now, to build up her power without limit. But what can the French do? They can't act alone. They don't have the forces. The British are unwilling to underwrite an active French policy looking to maintain the demilitarized status of the Rhineland, in spite of the fact that the British had committed themselves under the Locarno Treaty to guarantee the demilitarized status of the Rhineland. The British are very annoyed when the French remind them of this fact. Very unfriendly act, they say. Okay? The most they threaten the Germans with is economic sanctions. And when the Germans hear about this, it's practically break out the champagne. This is great. This is the most that they're going to threaten us with, right? They're going to take it to the League and threaten to impose economic sanctions. We're home free, okay? In fact, nothing happens. The Rhineland is remilitarized, and the whole balance of power in Europe is changed. France cannot move to the west. She cannot threaten Germany with attack. Germany starts fortifying her western border. People can see which way the wind is blowing. The second-order countries began shifting their alignments away from France and toward Germany. Italy kind of starts gravitating toward Germany, in large part as a result of the Ethiopian affair, which I'll talk about next time. Belgium withdraws from her alliance with France and returns to a policy of neutrality. Germany is becoming stronger and stronger, and freer to build up her power and then to contemplate her next moves in the East. And those next moves take place in 1938, and then finally have the War in 1939, and that's what I'm going to be talking about next.